102 KLRB.
And now back to part two of World Watchers International.
Okay, that, incidentally, on the newsstands right now, it's May 1981. I don't like to advertise these magazines for some of the things they have in there, but Penthouse is a series of articles that somebody told me about, and there's one on Jonestown this month, and there's one on the Bilderberger, the infiltration by a writer, Craig Carpell, who got into the Bilderberger in the last meeting in 1980, and talks about that. And there's an article in this issue also on cloning. The important thing, I think, of the Bilderberger meetings that he attended, the one that he attended, was that the people who run and push or make major decisions around the world of foreign policies, really who lives and who dies and who's conquered, they may have had the strength to make those opinions a long time ago and sit at a board and rearrange us like people on a chessboard is to be moved back and forth, and most of us being the pawns. But the situation, the international situation, has even gotten out of their control, so that by the time this Craig Carpell infiltrated the Bilderbergers of 1980, he came to the conclusion that the bulk of the meetings are trying to decide how to handle problems that have arisen, not how to create their own consensus and move countries. Years ago when they started, they could look at a map and say, what are we going to do with Iran? Well, we don't like Mossadegh. You know, we'll put in the Shah. What are we doing in Guatemala? Or what? How should we support Nicaragua, Somoza? And they can send in assassination teams if they don't like Fidel Castro. But everything they plan doesn't always go as according to plan. And now the world seems to be way out of their control. I can't even believe that a group as broad as the Bilderbergers in trying to cover all the bases can cover all the troubles that are going on today in the world. If you just take the headlines from this week in the newspapers with the imminent death of Bobby Sands and the conflict of the IRA in Great Britain, the sabotage of the airplane that Mrs. Gandhi was going to be on, and Mrs. Thatcher had just been in India, and they said there's evidence that Americans were involved in sabotage. This came over the radio from Europe, the shortwave radio. The money pouring into Iraq, funding Iran, and if Iran goes to the Soviet Union, the United States will have to face the two of them if we want to take them on. There's problems with Israel fighting Lebanon, and now Sadat is saying all the Arab nations should gang up and be firm against Israel, where he just signed a peace pact a while back. There was a coup in Spain, and the king objected. He accused the CIA of being behind it and forced General Haig to go there. I don't call him Secretary of the State. I call him General Haig, to go there for an extra 22 hours on his trip to Europe just a week ago. There's many problems, conflicts in South Africa, the United Nations turning against our own ambassador. And even today, I was surprised the World Affairs Council had their annual meeting, which is on the Monterey Peninsula, the California or West Coast branch of the World Affairs Council. And they were castigating our lady ambassador of the United Nations for her positions and really chewing her out. She was supposed to be here for the conferences and couldn't be here, but they wished that she had been here. And they were criticizing her strongly in her positions, and it was in the paper today. So the very conservative World Affairs Council isn't even putting up with the kind of behavior that she's displaying, meeting secretly with the African intelligence and running to South Africa and her vote in the United Nations this week. So a body of audience, I understand, got a round of applause for not approving of American policy and referring to our representative of the UN as being a clown. We can't watch Morocco. I was reading this week about the war in Morocco against Mauritania. And will India produce an atomic bomb? The United States is going to send billions to Pakistan. The United States is going to try to assume, along with a few allies, the debt of millions and millions from Poland. The Green Berets are fighting in Liberia, where the U.S. arms are being shipped again to South Korea. The Khmer Rouge are being funded by the CIA in Cambodia, if you like that one. How do you handle these things? The guerrillas are on the way to the Dominican Republic. Allegedly, the Dominican Republic, they were picked up, are the Alpha 66 anti-Castro Cubans, probably going to Cuba. And Alexander Haig, as I said, flying to Italy this week to explain why we decided to sell grain to the Soviet Union when we told our allies they couldn't. So then they're going to start selling and there'll be competition. And we've been apologizing and paying off Japan. Now it's $4 million. Soon it'll be $8 for sinking their submarine. Each one of these is a major crisis. So there's no one authority that can handle all these countries and say, I am in control. It looks, and this should make you happy, that in spite of the fact that the best plans were made by a group of fools to think that they could control all these countries, it looks like they couldn't possibly control all these countries. Alexander Haig tells Saudi Arabia, we'll send you these AWACS, these airplanes, and Israel complains, no, you can't do that. We need them too. And we promise Saudi Arabia will send you the pilots to fly them and then tell the Israelis, well, if they come over your country, you can shoot them down. And then we're shooting American pilots flying for Saudi Arabia. So those are just a few countries to give you an idea in case you're afraid that my broadcasts are doom and gloom each week. I do want to cheer you up to the fact that those people who cause so much pain in all these different countries are really not in control of the people or themselves. It's perfectly obvious that the system of supplying weapons and guns and ammunition is bankrupting every major country into this terrible inflation, whether it's Great Britain or Israel, Brazil, Argentina, United States, Germany. It's not working, and they have to come up with something better, and the sooner they do it, without causing wars to disguise what is happening. But I sincerely feel that if they called a war, they'd have trouble getting people to go. Even if they disguised it as a provocation of the Soviet Union, our allies would know it wasn't, and I think they would recognize the lies and wouldn't want to die about this. Now, the important news in my mind, and that's a lot of news, I'm rattling off, as I say, countries and incidences that deserve many, many more hours of explanation. But that John Hinckley shooting at the Old Corral at the Hilton Hotel is just too silent for May Brussels, if not for you. I don't like it. We're told that there was that one madman who shot four people and hurt them terribly in Washington, D.C. on March the 30th of this year. And there's still a question of whether there were two or more people shooting. Four people were gunned down like hunting victims. And the president was dragged in by the armpits into that hospital, bleeding out of the nose and mouth. We don't hear a word about John Hinckley. He hasn't been charged for shooting the press secretary. And that poor Mr. James Brady is critically ill, facing maybe another surgery. Half the brain was gone, and he seems to be struggling and is in terrible pain. That Tim McCarthy, who was in serious condition and released, hit in the abdomen, is out. We haven't heard about Thomas Delahanty, who got the bullet in the neck and had that close surgery for fear that it would explode inside his body. You saw television. You saw them gunned down. They replayed it over and over. And this is interesting for students of the assassinations and the attempted murder of President of the United States. And we don't know how he will go through this one yet. It's interesting because maybe you weren't around at Dallas 17 years ago and you don't remember, or in 68 when Robert Kennedy was shot, or in 1968 when Martin Luther King was killed, or even when Patty Hearst was kidnapped with the SLA, or the Manson family story that came out. There have been so many hoaxes and confusions, and now you can see for yourself the silencing that goes on when this person is a known member of the Nazi Party, kicked out for being too violent, taken to an American military base and then to a known mind control center, and we don't hear a word. Now, it's been weeks since the president was shot. This is May the 3rd. He was shot 30th of March. He was visiting with Prince Charles this week. And according to Associated Press story, and you can see it in the movies, Ronald Reagan is limping. And until the shootout, we didn't see a limp or any sign of a limp. And this week, Reagan told Prince Charles that his slight limp recently is from an old break in his thigh. It had nothing to do with falling off of horses. But in the physical examination, the story of this perfect specimen, this perfect 70-year-old specimen, before the shootout at the Old Corral, we didn't see him limping, and now he's having trouble with his thigh. Another important article by Maxine Cheshire, she has one every week in the Washington Post. If you get to read her column, it's very significant. And she was talking about the controversy of whether Ronald Reagan could take a little vacation because, you know, it gets hot in Washington in the summer. He wants to come out to Santa Barbara, his home, or whether he should hang around Camp David and stay in Washington, D.C. And she wrote this week, those who have been winning the argument to keep him convalescing at the White House and at Camp David feel it would be difficult, if not impossible, to keep him off a horse. Also, some argue that proximity to Washington is important if the public is going to perceive that Reagan is still running things. It's important if to perceive that Reagan is still running things. It reminds me of the play The Balcony by Jean Genet. I don't know how many of you saw it or read it, about three men in a horror house, and they wear costumes for their acts and get into it, and one's a priest, and one's a judge, and one's a general, and then their female companions dress appropriately to the way they are dressed, and the town is bombed, and they have to reassure the people in the town that the cardinal is there, and that the judge is there, and that the general is on hand. So the men who are at the whorehouse at the time, the plumber and different people, have to go out in the street in a parade in the costumes that they're using for their sexual fantasies, and they wave and act appropriately, and then the natives are satisfied. So as Maxine Cheshire says, it's important to perceive that he's still running things. So you might ask, who's running things? If we have to perceive it, then who's running it? Well, there was an article one of my listeners to the tape sent to me this month, March 1981, in the Washington Monthly. I don't know how many of you get that newsletter out of Washington, D.C. And it's an article about Alexander Haig, who I believe is absolutely the man to watch, the one who wants to run things. His getting up anxiously after the assassination attempt and saying the Constitution tells him he was in charge was just kind of a slip, because he really knows he wants to be in charge. And the article on Haig came out, as I say, in March, so it had to be printed or ready to go to print a month before, at least a month, in a small newsletter like this, before the shootout at the Hilton. And it's about the personality of Alexander Haig, and it warns about his wanting to be ambitious and work his way up. And in conclusion, the article says that he lost the vice president, running for the presidency. He wanted to be the president. He didn't even make it the primaries. But watch Alexander Haig, because not only a Secretary of Defense, but he has slots that he wants to fill. That's, in effect, what it's saying, that he wants to move up. And it goes into the biography of Forget Those Stories About Loyal Al Haig. This is from the article in Washington Monthly. It's misleading. He looks the part of a military man that's assigned to him. He looks like he would take orders and be commander-in-chief. But this author says, try listening to him instead of looking. Listen to the way he uses his words in public. Look at his career and review his career and see if you see a different, stranger truth that doesn't emerge. It's a curious thing that goes beyond authority. People at West Point obey orders and take authority, but Haig is not of that ilk. And it goes on to say that they were trained in West Point with the old honor, obey, and duty, the military values of honor, obey, and duty to your country. And he warns that Haig is of the post-war managerial ethic. That is the Reinhard Gehlen, Hitler's chief of intelligence, that formed our CIA. He formed the mentality for men like Haig, who go from the Defense Department, Defense Intelligence Agency, National Security Agency, CIA. It's not your duty and your country. It's how you roll yourself from one place to the other in order to be in those strategic locations. And this article tells about his Philadelphia birthplace. His father was an attorney who died when Haig was young. And remember, if you want them, you can order a back tape I've done on the Philadelphia connections to the past assassinations and conspiracies. He went to West Point, and then he went to Japan. Right after West Point, the vicar of America's foreign policy, and he questions this too, the right to say he's the vicar of that, went right to Japan, where he was under Douglas MacArthur. He graduated 214th out of a class of 310. So he was 68th or so from the bottom of his class at West Point, but graduated in 1947, the year that the CIA was formed, the National Security Council, and the CIA, and was flown immediately to Douglas MacArthur. And the author said you would expect that he'd be on the personnel staff and have some job placement knack and so forth. But Haig went with a man named Jonathan Ladd, L-A-D-D, Jonathan Ladd, who later became the commander of the Green Berets. Those were the counterintelligence spies that William Colby headed and had in all of Southeast Asia, and then brought home, as I said, to our West Coast to get their tentacles into the law enforcement in California. But they're all over the world. Jonathan Ladd went with Haig, and they went out with MacArthur, Douglas MacArthur, immediately after his graduation in 1947. And then when Chiang Kai-shek evacuated the mainland of China, Haig and Ladd went immediately to Taiwan to Chiang Kai-shek, and one of the main officers on the compound post at Taiwan for Chiang Kai-shek's arrival and assimilation into that location was a General Alonzo Fox. And by 1950, Haig had married his daughter, Patricia. So by 1947, when the National Security Council was formed, Haig was out of West Point and on his way with Douglas MacArthur. And in 1950, he had married the woman whose father was at Taiwan in charge of assimilating Chiang Kai-shek into that modus operandi. There's a book called Self-Destruction written by a man with a pseudonym. He uses the name Cincinnatus. He's an Army officer who writes in the book Self-Destruction that in the wake of the war after 1945, when World War II was over and he was in the Army, duty, honor, and country were replaced by something different, a need to be in the right place at the right time. That means that your duty and your honor and your country don't matter. You had strategic agents formed. We had the OSS that informed us of spies or danger from overseas that didn't do too well during, certainly at Pearl Harbor, which we knew about in advance. But we formed the CIA starting in 45 and had the National Security Council, National Security Agency in 47 when he got out of West Point, and he leaps to Douglas MacArthur in Southeast Asia. He's over in Taiwan with Chiang Kai-shek. And careerism, rather than dedication to one's men, was the way to get ahead. Now, that is the point when I began with the program, the Coalition for a Decent CIA, for a Decent USA, not CIA, asking the question, does Alexander Haig or do these people in control really want a decent USA? Is duty, honor, and country something that is passe, that they use their experiences to further the power of this fascism which they are ushering in? Haig was instrumental in landing at Incheon in South Korea on Douglas MacArthur's forces. And just recently, again, Maxine Cheshire has an article that the movie on Incheon, it's a $46 million glorifying this Korean adventure, is funded by Reverend Moon and a producer in Japan, a member of the Unification Church, with unlimited money, millions of dollars. And they used our Marine Corps, our Pentagon, our Army, United States Army, to help make this movie of the landing over in South Korea. And Reverend Moon and his gang have put up this money. Now, I got information a long time ago that the money for Reverend Moon came from Nazi money that was taken out of Germany when, at the end of the war, 1945, when Hitler collapsed, to make a resurgence for World War III using these funds. And Alexander Haig was in Southeast Asia with MacArthur. He was in South Korea. He's working with Reverend Moon and that gang from the Pentagon in making and glorifying this, and worked with Chiang Kai-shek, which means that the narcotics that funded through Chiang Kai-shek's operation in China and then continued from Taiwan could go into the resurgence and people of the ilk of Reverend Moon, who come out making movies like this for $46 million. Remember, he's the man who put up all that money for ads at the time that Nixon was going to be indicted for Watergate and was under suspicion. Incidentally, Alexander Haig works, or had worked, or still does for United Technology. And there's an account of United Technology in Wall Street Journal just last week, 2 weeks ago, in case you didn't see it, April 15th, from Hartford, Connecticut. It said, when Alexander Haig left the presidency of United Technology to become Secretary of State, he made a financial sacrifice. He makes 10% of the salary that he would at United Technology. He was pulling in a salary of $1.3 million. This is the salary at United Technology, and he's working for just a much less in the Pentagon at this time. But United Technology's profits through the decisions of war, we have to make war against Russia, we have to arm this country, we have to arm that. There, according to the Wall Street Journal, the United Technologies profits went up 15% in this last quarter from $3.33 billion. It used to be $2.89 billion, but in their quarter, just the last quarter, it went to $3.33 billion. And United Technologies is going to make the engines and the motors for the space colonies. And these have been also linked to NASA and Nazis. And I refer to the book Alternative 3 and other indications that a lot of treachery can come out of the building of the space colonies without supervision or people knowing what's going on. Alexander Haig once made a remark when they asked him, was he going to resign under some recent scandal? He says, I didn't come here just to shuffle papers. This is the kind of remark he makes. But this company, through his help of getting people so war-minded that we have to give contracts to everything that comes along because Russia is taking over the world, and yet the corporation that he was president of in the last quarter made $3.33 billion. And that goes back, I've spent a lot of time on Haig because he's the successor to the John Hinckley story and the shooting. If Reagan doesn't survive or gets sick, Haig has the ambition to be the president. If Bush is President, Haig would be handpicked as vice president. They would bypass other people, just as Gerry Ford was handplucked by Richard Nixon. In order for this to not happen, people have to be very alert and to watch Haig and his moves, and a lot of columnists are doing that. One article that was interesting this week on the John Hinckley case, and I will get into more of them next week and leave the international affairs aside, but the international policies are decided by people such as Alexander Haig, and as I say, Walter Stesel, the cabinet that is under Richard Nixon. And when a man is shot or knocked out of the running or immobilized or scared, such as Richard Nixon, then Haig can push these policies. I call him Nixon. Oh, forgive me. I can't tell the difference in my filing, hardly, between Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan. The same people put them into power, the same organizations, the same cliques, the same sleaziness, the people behind the deal with the rhetoric of the war and the terrorism. There's so little difference. But the point is that whether Richard Nixon is moved out of office and Alexander Haig becomes chief of staff in the White House and is bumping out people like Haldeman and not letting them reach the president and controlling the telephone. And remember, he was acting president at one time, at the time of Watergate, and showed how great he was and wants to be back there. When these people make such tremendous profits, and when the people, the masses of the people, are paying the taxes or are too poor to pay the taxes, have nothing or are scared of having anything and losing it, when these people move up and decide foreign policy and domestic policy and conceal the assassins of the men who precede them, then assassination is a good tool for them to assure their power and their profits. In this case, Haig has both. He works for a company that is a warfare company, president of the company, and makes decisions. It was the same way with Henry Kissinger. He's under the pay of Dave and Nelson Rockefeller when he made decisions to overthrow Chile or to have military juntas in other countries and cut off aid to countries that seemed democratic or leftist and support the military dictatorships, because the profits are greater for the oil companies if they don't have to pay the native populations. A man shouldn't be Secretary of State such as Henry Kissinger and be on the board of directors of Chase Manhattan working for David Rockefeller and have his wife under the pay of Rockefeller, and Haig working for president of this United Technology and making decisions of foreign policy. And as I mentioned before, and I want to do in the near future as soon as possible, go more into Fritz Kramer, the man from Nazi Germany who discovered Alexander Haig and Henry Kissinger. And the point is that when people from Nazi Germany are selecting our secretaries of state and selecting our foreign policies in the Pentagon, then you and I, the native population, can expect the same treatment they got in Germany, where Hitler can take control of the banks, you can get rampant inflation. The rich stayed rich. They were never poor, and they had their art treasures, and they had their trips and their pleasure palaces, and they knew the banking procedures if they lost the war to retrench. They had the guarantee of the Allies we wouldn't bomb their very important factories and the ITT factories that were making airplanes for Germany at the time. They were in the United States making wire and telephone poles for the United States. They controlled their profits while the small banks, the small businesses go under and the people get strangled. And it's very important to see the kind of president you have and the kind of cabinets they have, because what they did in the past is what you can expect for yourself. And the people that put them in, if you look at their lifestyles and read what they say and how they say it and how they acted, there's no reason to think you can't expect the same for yourself. Now, in addition, I have 1 minute to go. The silence on the Hinckley case is not only outrageous, but there's an article in the Washington Post this last week that the U.S. Attorney Charles Ruff, who would be prosecuting Regan's alleged would-be assassin, is being pushed away, and they're trying to bring in some other attorneys for the prosecution so that he won't be on the job. And the people deciding on legal counsel to take this federal position as U.S. attorney are being selected by Howard Baker of Tennessee and Strom Thurmond and Paul Lexalt and Governor Mathias of Maryland and Barry Goldwater in Arizona. Now, if Mr. Brady dies, it'll be hard to see how Hinckley can get off that case. But with this kind of removing the judge from the case and getting a handpicked judge for John Hinckley, plus Edward Bennett Williams of the CIA being his attorney, there is a lot of behind-the-scenes finagling that we'll go into next week. I just did want to update some of the international implications of men like Haig that move up through the bullet and can't get there voted in, tied up to strong fascist organizations all of their lives, and now are on the peak of controlling us through their offices in the White House. But we'll go back to Hinckley next week and pick up some of the details of that case. In the meantime, this is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California. You take care, and I'll be back with you next week.
This has been World Watchers International with noted conspiracy investigator Mae Bressel. This program originates from Carmel, California.